You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup. A coup in Sudan, world leaders gather in Rome. Also, what to expect from talks that have been described as the world's last best chance to avert a climate crisis. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a trio of Senate Democrats earlier this week released a proposal to institute a 15% minimum tax on large corporations. By large, that's businesses reporting annual profits of more than $1 billion at least 3 years in a row. This is another plan aimed at raising revenue to help pay for President Biden's Build Back Better agenda and the big spending plans Democrats have been negotiating. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how corporations currently handle taxes? What impressions do you have about the taxes larger companies pay, whether they contribute fairly compared with individual taxpayers or maybe with smaller businesses? Do you have thoughts about the idea of requiring a corporate minimum tax? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Thomas Kemp is professor and department chair at the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
From what you're seeing from Democrats here, what are we talking about with this idea, this concept of a corporate minimum tax?
Yeah, so there's a lot of moving pieces in all this, as I'm sure you and all the listeners appreciate. So it's not quite clear exactly how this is going to all plan out, but as it stands now, the call is for a, as you mentioned, a 15% corporate minimum tax on incomes for corporations earning annual revenues more than $1 billion. It's not clear at this point what specific deductions and write-offs, you know, may creep into that over the next hours and days, but that's where we are now. So the idea would be that, you know, that all firms of size would have to hit that 15%.
Can you talk about the discrepancy between what we hear argued about a lot, the corporate tax rate and the effective tax rate for corporations? Why is that not the same number?
Yeah, so the tax rate would be the rate on paper, right? So I have income of a certain amount, and that slots me into a certain income tax category, like you know how households have with their income tax. But then, of course, there are a variety of deductions and write-offs that firms can take, as well as a number of other strategies that can reduce their tax obligation, which then gives us the effective tax rate, or the rate of taxes actually paid against revenues earned.
A lot of people point toward loopholes in the tax code that allow corporations to do that, but one person's loophole might be another person's tax incentive, something introduced to have a certain outcome. Is it possible to sort out what we would call a loophole from a policy choice?
Well, that's a difficult thing to do because, as you say, loophole is a pejorative term we use to identifying tax policies that we don't like. Interestingly enough, in the broader Build Back plan, there are a number of tax incentives for shifting to, say, green manufacturing and green energy. Undoubtedly, those will, if they pass at some point in time, also be called loopholes in the tax policy. So it's really important to I think get away from the pejoratives and to start think about tax policy in terms of what we're trying to achieve as a society. Do those so-called loopholes achieve goals that we want to try to achieve as a society?
We're talking to Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair of economics at UW-Eau Claire, looking at the idea of a corporate minimum tax. It's one of many ideas on the table in Congress right now as part of the revenue side of spending plans from Democrats. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts on the idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tom, I think a lot of people look at this and think about the headlines you hear from time to time. Big corporation X paid X amount, zero amount of taxes in a particular year. How does that end up happening? Is it something that you think we should be worried about when it does happen?
Well, it happens for a variety of reasons, but the most common reason is they're taking advantage of loopholes, dare I say it, in the tax code. If they can effectively reduce their taxable earnings to zero, then their tax obligation is zero, of course. And you know, to a large extent, those laws exist for good reasons. They may have been historical reasons or current reasons, but you know, as a society, we put them there in place. And so, you know, if we feel that as a society that corporations aren't paying, you know, what we think they should pay, you know, that it may be time to start looking at what some of those deductions are or other possibilities that allow them to reduce their taxable earnings.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Whitewater. Andrew, hi.
Hi there. I just had a quick question on the constitutionality of adding another direct tax to businesses. Given that the Constitution states that in order for a direct tax to be applied, that it has to be apportioned, I wonder how the Congress will amend the Constitution to allow this, or how they plan to get around the Constitution on this issue.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Now, with the idea of a wealth tax, I've heard constitutional objections raised. Tom, have you heard anything like that about a corporate minimum tax, though?
No, I have not. That said, of course, you know, it's the legislative branch's mandate to pass laws, and then if there are objections to those laws on constitutionality bases, then it's up to the judicial branch to reach that finding, right? And so they're the arbiter of whether that's the case or not. And I suspect, right, that with this bill, and as with most large bills, there are many tests of its constitutionality, and that's how the system's supposed to work, right? So legislators legislate, and then the judicial branch makes sure, you know, keeps everybody in line, make sure we're following the other laws that we've set for ourselves.
Thanks for the call, Andrew, at 800-642-1234. Looking at this criteria, 3 years in a row with $1 billion revenue, that's not your garden variety corner store. What kind of companies do we know would be affected, Tom, under the plan as it currently stands?
Yeah, that's right. It isn't. So, you know, I'm concerned, I'm sure, that many people have, you know, that you know, you'd be hitting very small businesses with very small margins with these additional taxes. And you know, those firms that are, you know, under $1 billion in revenue, so $1 billion in revenue, right? So break that down into a, you know, you're talking, you know, millions daily, right? These are going to be quite large firms that are hit with this, you know, so your Apple Corporation, your Ford Motor Company, your Google, so on and so forth. Not the corner grocery store.
I know there are concerns sometimes about unintended consequences when we make a change in the tax code. We haven't tried this corporate minimum tax idea yet, but do you see any possible unintended consequences of setting this floor for a corporate minimum tax?
Yeah, I think it's vague enough at this point in terms of what's been said. It's hard to know. I think that's extremely likely that you know, we're going to end up seeing a whole bunch of deductions into this, right? So it isn't going to be, you know, just 15% on $1 billion and up, and that's going to be the end of it. There's going to be a variety of various incentives and other loopholes, again, dare I say it, written into this. That's probably where our objections and unintended consequences are going to come from.
We're talking. Go ahead.
No, that's it. Thank you.
We're talking to economics professor and department chair Thomas Kemp from UW-Eau Claire, looking at a proposal for a minimum corporate tax. It came from a trio of Senate Democrats, part of the effort to help pay for their infrastructure and social spending bills. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is fair to you when it comes to corporations and taxes? Do you think big companies should continue to be able to take advantage of credits and incentives and other opportunities in their tax code to pay a lower effective tax rate? Do you want to see this minimum corporate tax in place or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Thomas Kemp from UW-Eau Claire, talking about the prospect of a corporate minimum tax, how it would work, the effects it could have. It's on the table, at least right now, in Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think that big corporations pay their fair share in taxes? What would a fair share look like, if so? Do you like this idea or not? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Central Wisconsin. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
What do you want to bring up, Jeff?
Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, as I mentioned, coming into the conversation, but, I mean, this proposal has been visited many times before, and it solves all the problems, every single problem we have with taxes. The billionaire's tax, the millionaire's tax, the corporate tax is a flat tax. It's a simple concept. It solves everything. There's no. It's simply the more you spend, the more you're taxed. Rich people spend a lot more than the guy on welfare. So if you have a situation where you're out buying things, you will be taxed more. Simple. I don't understand. I know it has been addressed. I don't know why it's not being implemented.
And I just want to be clear, Jeff. A lot of times when people say flat tax, Jeff, they're talking about a percentage of income. You're talking about a percentage of sales, of consumption here. Do I have you right?
Percentage of consumption, correct.
Gotcha.
Whatever you spend, you're taxed on.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Tom, what do you think? Consumption taxes, I mean, we have sales taxes. Could that be the basis, though, for a wider system of taxation?
Well, as the caller mentioned, it's certainly been proposed a number of times to have a wholly consumption-based tax. Like with any proposal, there are some pros and cons associated with those types of taxes. I hesitate to start a lecture on what those may be. Suffice it to say that one challenge to those types of taxes is that, as the caller mentions, obviously people of means tend to buy more things than people of more modest incomes. But of course, people of more modest incomes also spend a larger portion of their income on consumption goods, right? So rather than, say, investment goods. People of more modest incomes are generally spending virtually all of their income in consumption, and thus virtually all of their income would be taxed. Whereas people of more significant means have the ability to store away some of their income in a variety of forms and would thus be able to avoid that tax. So the problem of people of means avoiding taxes has always been with us and will likely always be with us.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom, I've seen one argument in favor of the corporate minimum tax going along this kind of lines. Big companies have an unfair advantage in some ways over smaller companies because they can afford the best accounting and legal minds to help them avoid taxes. The mid-sized company, maybe they've got okay accountants. The smaller company, the owner is the accounting department.
Yeah.
Does this make a more level playing field potentially for businesses of different sizes?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if that will end up being the case, but I think that it's pretty clear that that's one of the goals that's trying to be achieved here. And that's a real thing, right? If you're a small business, it's just a struggle to keep on top of all these regulations and tax codes. Whereas if you're a billion-dollar enterprise, you have a team of professionals that that are out there working on that problem every day. And so that does create the possibility of some real inequities. Whereas if you sort of created, this sort of thing where it's a sort of additional tax or an additional minimum tax really on really only larger firms, potentially you get away from some of those inequities.
An argument against sometimes any tax increase on wealthier people or corporations is that, well, they're just going to find another way with those fine accounting and legal minds to avoid these taxes. Do you think that's a reason to not pursue this kind of thing?
Well, I'm going to try to stay away from what my opinion on is on these things. I have an opinion. I think that taxes are a question of what society wants. So how society wants to, where it wants to get money from for public purpose and how it wants to spend that money on public purposes. And so to the extent that we're having a discussion about who should be taxed and how they should be taxed, I think that's a positive thing for everybody and for our society. And that's what I at least see going on here to some extent.
We're talking to Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair in the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics, looking at the idea of a corporate minimum tax. It is one of the ideas on the table among Democrats in Congress, looking for ways to pay for it, to offset at least some of the costs of their infrastructure and social spending packages. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go now to David on the line in Deerfield. David, hi.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, David?
You know, just thinking about the corporate taxes and the people who don't pay taxes, corporations that can give the Republican Party a couple of years ago $450 million, but they don't pay any taxes in Beloit, Wisconsin. And my point that I thought about is when people are involved with a corporation where they have a hold of a lot of money, you know, CFOs, CEOs, COOs, whoever they are, and think about it. They say, gosh, I'd like to have a rocket that I can charge people money and we'll go in orbit just around the Earth. Think about when those people are saying that. Do they think about the people that put $4 worth of gas in the tank of their car because that's all they can afford that time? Corporations should be paying more. They should be paying something. And when you see corporations that can finagle their way out of paying anything, I'm old enough that I remember the Silverado affair with the savings and loans. And there were people who stole hundreds of millions of dollars, and 200 wasn't enough for somebody. The next person stole 300. The next person stole 400.
I gotcha. David, thanks a lot for the call. Now, David, thanks for calling in. Tom, Pew Research shared results of a survey in April this year that showed a lot of people, I think, are on a page with our caller. 81% of Americans said that corporations don't pay their fair share. At least this perception here is out there, Tom, that, people do want to see corporations pay more.
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing. Boy, you know, you look at those numbers that you cited a little earlier about large firms and them not paying any taxes, and you know that gets my blood up a little bit, and I'll bet you it gets, well, Pew Research suggested it gets a lot of people's blood up. So I can certainly understand that. I mean, the challenge with this thing is that, you know, for larger firms, it's relatively easy. I don't mean to say it's zero cost, but it's relatively easy for them to move earnings overseas. Right? And that's one of the significant ways in which they're able to reduce their tax obligation. And of course, the federal government has, you know, very limited authority, when we're discussing overseas activities. And so some of this conversation that we're hearing around this about, you know, global minimum tax, as well as, you know, the Biden administration has thrown us out there. A couple senators have been discussing these ideas. It's been a challenge for a long time to try to get some of the larger firms to pay taxes because of the relative ease of which they can avoid taxes. And so, you know, to me, if we think of ideas of taxes, sort of this social discussion, right? The fact that we're sort of beginning to start seeing a global discussion about what corporate taxes should be, I think it's going to be a while in coming, but it's at least the beginnings of starting to think about how we can stop this, right? So we can stop this sort of race to the bottom with corporate taxes and large business entities.
Thanks for the call, David. We'll go next to Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. As I hear the corporate tax, I think our party is confused because the corporations, when they are taxed to 15%, the corporation is simply going to pass on that expense to the consumer. And what happens with the consumer is that the wealthy consumer won't have a problem getting 15% increased taxes on their bread or on their food or on their cars. That won't bother them. But the middle income and the lower income people will be punished by it. The same thing has just happened. as gas prices have gone up 50%, and the people that are wealthy, they don't care that they pay a little bit more for their gasoline. But the people that are middle income and the people that are lower income that are trying to get to work, they're being crushed by these kind of taxes. So
I gotcha. Tom, we don't have too much time left. Tom Kemp, the idea that you raise a tax on a corporation, well, we end up paying for it anyway.
Well, it's true. I mean, some of taxes are going to be passed on to the consumer. However, in most markets, not 100% of that is going to be passed on to the consumer. It takes certain market irregularities for a firm to be able to pass 100% of a cost on to a consumer. So we shouldn't sort of think of this as a complete zero-sum gain. Does it produce the, you know, sort of are the on paper results exactly what ends up happening? No, this it's more complicated than that. But as you mentioned, I think most people are of the opinion that, you know, these taxes should be raised. And again, it's about what society thinks should happen in the whole.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Tom, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. Always a pleasure.
That's Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair in the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. We talked to him about corporate minimum taxes, like the one being produced by a small group of Democratic senators. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, climate change could lead to increased threats to communities on Great Lakes coastlines. Wisconsin has a lot of those. We'll find out what's at stake and how people are responding. Voting policies are getting a close look in Wisconsin, in the legislature, and in the race for governor. We'll look at questions over the ways that people deliver absentee ballots and how people in nursing homes can vote. And we'll visit a little free library in Green Bay that's spreading art instead of books. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a pediatric infectious disease specialist explains the ins and outs of the Pfizer COVID vaccine for kids from 5 to 11. That was just approved by the FDA today. It still needs CDC approval. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we tackle pizza with a capital P, with the chef behind a new definitive 4-volume guide to the history and making of all pizzas, great and small. First, an FDA advisory panel recommended this week that the agency approve the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine for kids aged 5 to 11. The panel said evidence from the clinical trial shows that the benefits of a shot for younger kids outweigh the risks. And the agency followed up on that recommendation this afternoon, giving the authorization for that age group. The CDC would still have to sign off on that decision to make vaccines available to the 5 to 11 age group. They're expected to meet on that on Tuesday. COVID has been way less dangerous for kids than for adults, but the recommendation notes that COVID-19 was the 8th leading cause of death for kids aged 5 to 11 in the last year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have kids in that age group? Are you planning on getting them vaccinated? Have you been eagerly awaiting this announcement? Do you have questions still about the vaccine, how it works for a younger age group? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. James Conway is the Associate Director for Health Sciences at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute. Dr. Conway is an expert in pediatric infectious diseases and Medical Director for UW Health's Immunizations Programs. Dr. Conway, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you talk about what's gone into this vaccine for kids so far that's got us to the state today of the FDA saying, yeah, let's go ahead with this?
Yeah, it's been fascinating and, you know, moving at a relatively good clip, although I think people are at some levels a little frustrated that these things take a while. But, you know, basically what we've done for pediatrics is taken everything that was learned in the adult process, figuring out what's the right dose initially, and then in larger and larger groups, making sure that it's safe and, more importantly, that it also provides the protection that's needed. And so then in the pediatric side of things, same thing has happened. We're figuring out the appropriate dose, making sure that it is effective at protecting against the disease, but most importantly, making sure that it's safe. And so we are now at the point where we're on the cusp of actually being able to start vaccinating this 5 to 11 year group in the next couple of weeks.
You mentioned the dosage, and as I understand it, Dr. Conway, this is a smaller, a lower dosage of the Pfizer vaccine than a grown-up would get.
Correct. This is going to be about a third of what the adults have been getting. And, you know, this has been a really important point in understanding how to make these vaccines for children, is really making sure that everybody understands that they're not just little adults. And so the same as what was done in the adults, trying, you know, sort of medium, high and low doses to figure out which gets you the best response, was done in kids as well. So they did that in a small number of kids and figured out that for the 5 to 11 year olds, they only need about a third of the dose to get the same level of an immune response, but it spares you a lot of those side effects.
What's the timeline from here until a parent could sign up their kid for an appointment for that first dose?
Yeah, so November 2nd is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, which is the advisory to CDC. They're going to review this. And I think the conversation is going to be interesting because, as we saw at the FDA discussions last week, there are some of the advisors who are wondering whether we should be recommending this for every kid or whether this should be earmarked just for particular kids that are at high risk for complications. And so that's going to be one of the major points of discussion. I anticipate that they probably will make this widely available for all kids. Then CDC has to review that because this is just an advisory. So CDC has to review it, and the head of CDC then needs to sign off on it. And then once they sign off on it and make it full policy, then essentially the floodgates will open. Vaccine will start to be available at providers and people will be able to start getting those vaccines. So we're expecting that all of that should fall into place by the end of next week. And so I think that by certainly the beginning of the following week, we should be good to go.
Talking to Dr. Jim Conway from UW-Madison's Global Health Institute, Director for UW Health's Immunizations Programs, looking at the Pfizer vaccine and kids. The FDA says, yes, we can do this. The Pfizer vaccine formulated for kids 5 to 11 got their thumbs up, goes to the CDC, as we just heard, next week. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions about vaccines, COVID-19 vaccines for kids age 5 to 11. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Conway, a lot of people looking at the risk levels of COVID-19 for kids. We know it's way less of a threat for younger people than it is for grownups, and especially for seniors. From your background in pediatric infectious diseases, can you tell us what we've seen with COVID-19 and kids in this age group?
Yeah, I think what we've learned from, you know, the SARS-CoV-2 virus as it infects people is that it's really unpredictable. And so while there are certainly groups that you can point to and say they are at much higher risk for having complications, unfortunately, we've seen plenty of healthy young adults and healthy children who've also had particularly severe disease. And this is kind of similar to what we see with influenza, where, you know, most people who are otherwise healthy do fine with it. But every year, unfortunately, some healthy people don't do so well. And so that's basically what we've seen in pediatrics for COVID-19. The other piece, though, I think that people need to remember is that I think there was a little bit of a misconception early on, because we were being so careful with mitigation and schools being closed and keeping kids in bubbles. I think people had this impression that kids just didn't get this infection. I think now that we've released them back into the wild and have them back in schools and all these things, we've seen the kids get infected at the exact same rates that adults do. And again, while they still generally do pretty well with these infections, you know, we still know that, you know, 1 or 2% of them get hospitalized with this. And there's been, you know, hundreds of deaths, you know, more deaths from COVID than we have in even the worst influenza seasons. So this is a bad actor. And I think that's part of the reason that people have been so eager to be able to protect this group of the population from this unpredictable virus.
For parents out there with kids who might be at higher risk for COVID-19, first of all, who is that? Who should be maybe trying to make sure they get this vaccine earlier than later for their kids?
Well, I mean, if you think about it the same way we think about the boosters in adults, there's sort of a group of people that absolutely should get it. So in the adults for boosters, it's, you know, over 65 and people with underlying medical conditions. And then there's a group of people that may get it, which are people that are just at higher risk for coming into contact with it, teachers, health providers like myself, first responders and the like. And so I think for kids, I think that's, you know, sort of a similar paradigm. There's kids that absolutely should get it, you know, kids with underlying medical conditions, especially immune compromising conditions, kids that are on immune suppressive drugs, kids with underlying heart and lung problems, kids with diabetes, you know, really, you know, kids with obesity, really any sort of medical condition does set you up for a worse version of the infection. But I think that we need to think about kids also the way we think about the group of people who are just at higher risk for coming into contact with this. And so I think the kids that are in schools, kids that are in large group settings, really should strongly consider getting this as well. They are clearly both drivers of circulation in the communities and are the ones that often bring it home into their families. And, you know, even though many of the family members are already vaccinated, there are even in those populations some breakthrough cases that can go bad. So I think there's a group of kids that absolutely should get it, but I really think that most people should be thinking about this for their kids.
I wanted to ask you about that from the public health standpoint, apart from protecting individual kids. I know people at the national level have been trying to model the impact of vaccinating X number of kids in this age group and figuring out how much that can help shut down COVID, period. What are you watching for there?
Yeah, it's hard and it's a little tricky because, you know, most of this is done based on people with symptomatic disease. And I think what we've, you know, realized is that there are also people out there with this infection that we just never know about. They have such mild symptoms and don't get themselves tested. And I think that's the tricky part of all this modeling. You know, as we say, some, you know, all models are wrong, some models are useful. And, you know, I think that that's the best guessing that they've been able to do is that it's proven that in communities with lots of kids or in families with kids, those communities and those families are more likely to have ongoing transmission. So it does seem that kids serve as a driver for ongoing transmission. And again, it's largely because they are a largely unvaccinated population, because when you really sort of take a step back, this is largely a disease and an outbreak currently of unvaccinated populations. And obviously this group of kids under age 12 are all unvaccinated. So they really are the ongoing drivers in many places of the ongoing transmission.
We're talking to pediatric infectious disease expert Dr. Jim Conway about the FDA's approval today of a COVID-19 vaccine for kids age 5 to 11, a dose of the Pfizer vaccine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know from our guest about how the COVID vaccine for children was developed and the safety and efficacy of it? What are you thinking if you're a parent of kids? Have you been eagerly awaiting approval? Do you still have questions you feel like you want answered? What do you want to know? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about COVID vaccines for younger kids, age 5 to 11 now, with Dr. Jim Conway, pediatric infectious diseases expert at UW-Madison. The FDA has given it the go-ahead. The CDC expected to weigh in next week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about COVID vaccines for younger people. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring up a caller now. Thea is with us in Milwaukee. Thea, hello.
Hi there. I had a question a little bit outside of this age range. I have a 7-week-old, and I know, of course, there isn't any evidence just yet about vaccines for a much younger population, but I've been trying to keep an eye on what's in the news, and I haven't seen anything for, you know, the much, much younger group, and I wanted to know if there was anything out there about testing for younger people and what information there might be.
Thanks for the call, Thea. Dr. Conway, what is going on with kids under 5 in the research?
Yeah, Thea, thank you. And I'm glad you asked. You know, we are now in the process of actually doing the trials on kids from 6 months of age up to 5 years of age. Both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are moving along with data coming along that hopefully will be completed by the end of the year. I think the enrollment in those age groups is nearing completion, but then to make sure that they have enough time for watching for side effects, then it's a couple of months after that to make sure that everything looks good. But I think we're forecasting that probably very early in 2022, we'll probably see the opportunity to be able to start immunizing those younger ones. I don't think that there's going to be a lot of push to immunize ones quite as young as yours, and congratulations on your new special friend. But instead, I think the goal is really going to be to continue to draw some attention to the importance of vaccinating pregnant women, which then conveys some immunity to the babies that covers them for those first 5 and 6 months, and then vaccine will be available after that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Thea, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Conway, when drug and vaccine makers are looking at the safety of a drug or vaccine, they're watching, of course, for possible side effects, but then weighing the risks of those side effects from the vaccine with the risks of getting the disease because you're not vaccinated. How do we sort out the math there?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rob. You know, I think one of the things people need to remember is that vaccines are held to a standard that's, you know, really much higher than drugs, because as you think about drugs, drugs are being used to treat a condition. And if you're treating especially a serious condition, you know, you're willing to tolerate some side effects. Vaccines are being given basically to healthy people to keep them healthy. And so there's a lot less tolerance for side effects. And so that's the reason the drug trials are a little bit smaller often than vaccine trials that tend to be tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, is to really tease out all of those side effect things. You know, and so I think that's part of the reason that these pediatric trials took a while, is they really wanted to work these things out in adults, especially adults where the risk was higher for them having unfortunate outcomes, make sure we understood everything we could about the immunology, and then moved into these younger kids. And, you know, one of the things I'm very encouraged by is that each of the companies has been trying different doses to try to basically see how low a dose can you get away with that still gives you enough immune response, but minimizes all of those side effects. And so that's where this is moving, and I think in a very encouraging way.
One thing people may have heard about is a rare side effect, an elevated risk of myocarditis, especially in younger men or older boys, I guess, from the vaccine. But then researchers point out having COVID-19 has a huge boost in your risk of myocarditis for that same age group. Is that an example of the kind of compare and contrast we're trying to do?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think it's been important to understand this myocarditis thing, you know, and certainly in those young adults that are getting the full adult dose, you know, they certainly get a very robust immune response. And some of that immune response does cause a little bit of inflammation in other areas of the body. That's why when people, especially getting their second dose, get that sort of achy flu-like feeling, that's your immune system getting turned on, developing the immunity, but it does sort of make you feel crummy for a couple of days. And in some of those people, that inflammation has affected their hearts. And so I think that was one of the reasons that everybody hit pause and then have been really intentional about making sure that we got away with the lowest dose possible, but also keeping an eye on things for a couple of months in these vaccine trial groups to make sure that we don't miss anything. You know, I think people always need to remember, you know, when we talk about short and long-term side effects, short-term side effects are, you know, hours to days. Long-term side effects, there's really never been any long-term side effect that showed up more than a couple of months after the vaccines were given. So when people sort of look at how quickly this has gone, you know, I think that they need to be reassured that that part was not by any means shortened. It was really just the bureaucratic and regulatory part of this that allowed this to happen in a little bit faster fashion than usual.
Talking to Dr. Jim Conway, pediatric infectious disease expert at UW-Madison and at UW-Health. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234 as we continue our conversation about Pfizer immunizations getting FDA approval for 5 to 11-year-olds, still waiting on CDC approval, possibly as soon as next week. Mark joins us now in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I got a question. Since the mortality rate on the very young is virtually zero, is it wise to go ahead and give them vaccinations? Just the mere transportation in an automobile to the places where they could get it, it probably has a higher mortality rate than the disease.
Mark?
Yes, thanks, Mark. Really interesting question. And, you know, I certainly appreciate that perspective. I think one of the things we need to always remember about vaccines and vaccine preventable diseases is that while many of us were growing up, the focus was on diseases that killed people. We've really over the last 20 years shifted our focus not to just things that kill people, but the diseases that cause significant morbidity, in other words, damage and long-lasting effects. And so while you're right that, you know, I haven't looked at the numbers this week, but, you know, 500 or 600 children have died from COVID, which is, you know, again, much worse than even the worst flu seasons. But more importantly is the morbidity, both the illness and the sometimes prolonged hospitalizations, but then the sequelae of that. We certainly see long haul COVID in kids. We see kids that have had lifelong neurologic, cardiac, and lung damage that happens after their COVID. And kids are a little strange in that they actually have two opportunities to get whacked by COVID. They have the acute illness, where typical like the adults, you know, it's primarily a respiratory pneumonia and then other symptoms. But then they have this second opportunity after they recover from the initial infection, where they get this MIS-C disease, where their immune system actually goes haywire and starts attacking itself. And that's as much of a concern as any. And so you're right to sort of take a step back and look at this and say, you know, is this worthwhile from a mortality standpoint? You're right, it's probably a wash, but it's the morbidity part of it that really tips the balance in favor of needing to protect children against this disease, again, because it's so unpredictable. You know, the added bonus from a public health standpoint is they also are drivers for ongoing circulation within communities. And it would certainly allow more schools and more of their extracurricular activities to go back to being a lot more normal, hopefully without masks eventually for most settings, if we could prevent them from having transmission issues at all. But you're right to draw attention that it's not just mortality, it's morbidity and the other factors that are really going to drive that equation.
Thanks for that call, Mark. We heard from Patrick in Madison, who had a related question, not directly to kids, but also in the news, booster doses for vaccines. Patrick is wondering how, if in any way, is the booster dose someone might get different from the first two doses, or in the case of Johnson & Johnson, the first dose?
Yeah, good question. So for the Pfizer vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, both of those boosters are full dose and essentially just the exact same vaccine that they got for their first dose of Johnson & Johnson or first doses of Pfizer. The Moderna vaccine, which always has been a higher dose, you know, it's about 100 micrograms of the antigen versus about 30 micrograms in the Pfizer vaccine. The Moderna vaccine, because it's got so much more oomph in those initial two doses, actually doesn't need as much of a boost. And so the booster dose for Moderna is actually half of the dose of the original. You know, the FDA and CDC have approved if, you know, vaccine isn't available or if people want to choose to go with the mix and match, that they can consider that. But I just caution people to remember that the trials where they looked at mix and match were actually using full dose Moderna, full dose Pfizer, and full dose Johnson & Johnson. But the approved boosters are half dose Moderna, full dose Pfizer, and full dose Johnson & Johnson. So just to be cautious for those boosters, if people are going to mix and match, that understanding that there's a little bit of a difference. So the Moderna booster is actually a much smaller dose than the original dose.
Getting back now to the Pfizer vaccine for kids, assuming it gets approved, say, next week, logistically, are there doses ready to rock and distribute and give to kids, or is this going to take a while to ramp up?
Yeah, great question, Rob. You know, the Moderna half dose is basically pharmacies and providers are just drawing up half the dose literally out of the same vial. The pediatric one-third dose of the Pfizer is actually a completely different and separate formulation and separate packaging. You know, we've been assured by the CDC and the White House that they have adequate supplies of those vaccines from Pfizer, that they've been in production for a while, and that they are ready to drop and ship as soon as the approvals come through next week. So I think we're relatively certain, but I think there's always going to be a little bit of a delay between those decisions and announcements being made and everything being moved into place. And so that's why I think that by early the following week, I think is when people should expect that this will be good to go. But stay tuned, because obviously there's a lot of moving parts with all of this.
In our last half a minute or so, what are you watching for next, Dr. Conway, in the progress of this pandemic?
Yeah, I think the next things are going to be Moderna coming in probably with their data for their 6 to 11-year-olds. I think we're going to continue to monitor to see how long the booster protection lasts and whether subsequent boosters are necessary in the future. And obviously the million-dollar question is, you know, was that our last big wave, or is there another one coming up as holiday travel and people start to congregate more? And so time will tell. And so I think we all need to stay careful, but trying to encourage unvaccinated individuals to jump on board, I think, is going to be really our best path out of this once and for all.
Dr. Conway, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. James Conway, Associate Director for Health Sciences at UW-Madison's Global Health Institute, Medical Director for UW Health's Immunizations Program, and expert in pediatric infectious diseases. He talked to us about the Pfizer COVID vaccine for kids age 5 to 11, just approved by the FDA today. As we've been hearing, it goes now to the CDC for a final sign-off. Coming up after the news, we want to hear your pizza questions, comments, toppings, and tales. We're talking with the co-author of Modernist Pizza. It's a big book. It's 4 books for this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.